brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Hello, listeners. Today is Thursday, August 3rd, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. We're going to start off this week talking about one of the big policy planks of President Donald Trump's campaign, immigration. He and a couple of Republican senators rolled out a big piece of new immigration legislation this week aimed at reducing the amount of legal immigration, the number of green cards issued per year into the United States. We're going to talk about what is in that bill, how it kind of fits into the Trump administration's daily political strategy, and also a little bit of what's going on inside the West Wing right now, which we've been talking about a lot. There's yet more new stuff this week. We're also going to dive into a couple of Senate races. We're going to talk this week about Arizona, home of Senator Jeff Flake, who has, in the past week, has really amplified himself. He's always been a never-Trump voice within the Republican Party, one of the few remaining ones among congressional Republicans. But he's got a book out. He's been making a lot of media appearances. And despite the fact that he's up for re-election in 2018, he's really leaning into this at a time when President Trump has taken control of the Republican Party. On the flip side, we're also going to be talking about the upcoming Alabama Senate special election, where every Republican in the race wants to be standing with Trump as they get ready to face Alabama GOP primary voters on August 15th in that race to complete the term once filled by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. A couple things before we start that conversation. Remember, please email us at nerdcast@politico.com if you have any questions, and please subscribe, rate us, and write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform. We really want your feedback. We want to keep improving the show, expanding the audience. So please, if you have time, write a review of the show on Apple Podcasts or another app. All right, here's our panel this week. Got a little bit of a different look. Nancy and Eliana couldn't make it, but we have, making his Nerdcast debut, White House correspondent Josh Dossi. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian.
Hey, Scott.
Fresh off his star turn at Politicon last weekend. It sounded like the show went really well.
Yeah, it went really well. We had a nice turnout, and it was great to meet some of our listeners afterwards. We had a blast.
That's so great. Unlike the newsroom, people listen to you?
People are actually nice to us there.
Oh, really?
Unlike the newsroom.
All right. Here is our first segment this week. The data point is this number, 500,000, and that is the targeted reduction in green cards that would be issued each year by the U.S. government under new legislation that President Donald Trump officially endorsed on Wednesday. Here's Trump unveiling the proposal alongside Senate co-authors Tom Cotton and David Perdue.
The RAISE Act ends chain migration and replaces our low-skilled system with a new points-based system for receiving a green card. This competitive application process will favor applicants who can speak English, financially support themselves and their families, and demonstrate skills that will contribute to our economy.
Okay, so Josh, Politico readers will not have been surprised by Wednesday's announcement if they read the story that Eliana and you wrote, last month about what was coming down the pike. But so let's talk about everything that's going on in here. This is a proposal about legal immigration, not illegal immigration, and what's inside it.
Right. So this has been a brainchild of Stephen Miller, longtime Jeff Sessions aide, is now, you know, top policy advisor and speech writer to President Trump, who, you know, has long decried too much illegal immigration, not illegal immigration, but legal immigration. And he had been working quietly on the Hill with David Perdue of Georgia and Tom Cotton of Arkansas to craft a plan that would cut this by half over 10 years, a pretty drastic step by all accounts. And it's kind of one of the ways that President Trump is trying to fulfill his immigration agenda, where, you know, you have the wall that's probably not happening anytime soon. You have the travel ban that has been blocked on multiple occasions. It's kind of his legislative front to begin, telling his base, okay, actually, we are going to do this. But, you know, I think at best, it has a very slim chance of passing in Congress. A lot of it is, you know, just talking about what we'd like to do. I don't think this is going anywhere fast.
Mm-hmm. I mean, 4 years ago, 68 senators voted for a very different type of immigration reform bill, right? It was the gang of, what was it, eight?
I think it was eight. I lose track of the gangs. From a practical standpoint, it's hard to see how it gets passed just based on what we've seen from the White House recently. It's a complex and controversial measure, and there's really little evidence that the White House has the discipline or the dexterity to make this happen. And then you've got all the other issues in the background that are going to suck up all the oxygen, whether you're talking about tax reform, debt ceiling, and then comes then we're on the silly season of 2018. So, I mean, it's really hard to see where this goes.
What specifically is in here? We talked about that top line number, the 50% cut down to below 500,000 from about 1 million green cards that are issued every year. How does this legislation go about doing that, Josh? What are the kind of specific ways in which it would cut this down?
Well, it's what they're trying to do, and as Charlie said, I think it's very unlikely that it happens, but it's kind of a merit-based immigration system where the administration controls who comes in the country, people that they believe to be, you know, beneficial to America. Now, that's a tough thing to judge. What's beneficial to you, maybe not what's beneficial to me. But what the administration is trying to do is cut the numbers down to where they control, you know, the type of person who comes in the country based on various criteria. And one thing that senior administration officials have told us is, you know, they want to keep people from coming in the country that are going to be on welfare or that the government's going to have to support. They want higher earners. They want folks who, you know, contribute to sectors they see as important. So it's controversial at least. And, you know, I think there could even be legal challenges crafted to it as well.
What else is new?
But what else is new? We've been in legal fights for 7 months now. So the other thing, though, I think we should point out is that, you know, President Trump and his team, they like fights. I mean, we saw the first weekend they came out with this travel ban. It was just, you know, aggressive. People weren't briefed, protests at the airports, court challenges. You know, the transgender military ban a couple weeks ago or last week, time is all a flat circle. But, you know, they like these cultural fights where even if they don't actually get something done or even if they don't implement it, it kind of shows us against them. You know, this is what we're trying to do. This is why you elected us. And, you know, it's going to be chaotic.
Well, that actually brings us to yesterday's White House briefing when they were rolling out this policy, right, Charlie? I mean, there was a big blow up between Stephen Miller, the Trump aide, and I think most notably Jim Acosta of CNN.
The Statue of Liberty says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free. It doesn't say anything about speaking English or being able to be a computer programmer.
Even. Jim, do you believe?
Going to be highly skilled. They're not always
Jim,
going to be
Jim, Jim, I appreciate your speech. Down, Jim, I appreciate your speech. So tell me what years meet Jim Acosta's definition of the Statue of Liberty poem, Law of the Land.
Yeah, I mean, what I found interesting is in some ways it seemed like the most or maybe one of the more traditional policy rollouts of this administration. You know, it was an endeavor that was not rooted in norm breaking. It
or
was
Twitter.
Not rolled out on Twitter. It did not have the same kind of seat of the pants. We're just winging it here. Feel that so many of the other policy rollouts have. And the other thing I think that's really important to keep in mind here, and I think the White House understands this, is that this is a very polarizing, volatile issue, and it always has been throughout American history. I mean, just decade by decade by decade, you will see this fight. And I think the idea that that some of their proposals are far from the mainstream is mistaken. There will be a lot of support out there. My guess is particularly for the English language provisions, which really sparked the fight, the dust up in the you know, at the press conference yesterday. And I think that if this is something that is going to accrue to their benefit in a way that maybe some of the other traditional policy rollouts
that polls very well on both parties that we've already seen.
And that is a broader thing the Trump administration has tried to reiterate over and over again. You saw yesterday in the briefing room, Stephen Miller said, look how this polls, look how this is being covered in local media. You know, the travel ban is the same way. You know, there was months of chaos, lots of protest, and then, you know, pretty high approval ratings, somewhere near 50% for the travel ban, even above. One of their most, I think, interesting political tactics is they make Democrats and liberals defend things that are not necessarily that popular. You know, the travel ban, arts funding, you know, transgender folks in the military. I mean, they put these cultural issues where there is actually kind of a broad support across the country for probably what their policy is, even if it's controversial
or some version of it, not necessarily exactly as they've phrased it.
They kind of put folks on their heels, and it's an interesting strategy, I think, you know, even with a policing rhetoric. A lot of Americans want strong policing. They don't mind when the president says, you know, if he's a murder suspect, rough him up a little bit. A lot of this is not politically correct, but outside of Washington and I think New York, there's probably a lot of people who support a lot of it.
I think it's a great point to make. They're very good at identifying these cultural wedge issues and at identifying the issues that Americans talk about, maybe not in public. But here's the problem. I think Democrats have gotten a pass so far because of the inability to execute in the White House, the gross incompetence, the distractions, the other controversies. But once the White House, or if the White House is ever able to really operate in a normal fashion and actually execute, then this is going to be a very interesting election if they continue to identify these cultural wedge issues.
Well, and you know, I was thinking about in context, obviously this the different sides of the issue, but we're talking about this as the, you know, first week, wrapping up the first week of the new White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, who was, as the DHS secretary before this, was responsible for executing Trump's immigration policy. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, the extent to which he will be able to exercise control over the West Wing. And certainly we have seen, not that it stopped anyone from predicting this in the past, but it wouldn't be the first time people have predicted that things were going to kind of smooth out a little bit for the Trump administration. But as Charlie noted before, this was a normal, boring policy rollout.
Right. Here's what I'm hearing about John Kelly so far internally. You know, we've seen tweets already that are a little erratic. I don't think he's going to control the president. I don't think you're going to have a president who stops watching Fox and Friends, or, you know, sometimes goes to the fringe. I do think what John Kelly's doing, based on the folks I talk to in the White House, is, you know, making the staff feel a little bit more that things are under control. You know, putting some protocols in place where people don't just walk in the meetings in the middle and up in them, where briefing materials have to go through agencies, they have to be vetted, where staff meetings have an agenda and some rhyme and reason. So what I'm kind of sensing so far is that President Trump, you know, I don't think is going to make any sort of drastic fundamental change. I think what John Kelly is trying to do is, you know, put better information in front of the president, get the staff to stop fighting as much, get the staff to feel like there's kind of a common goal and a common aim, and just put together some basic business practices that would have happened in any other West Wing but have not happened so far in this one, where, you know, there is, you know, an interagency process to do things. There is, you know, a decision meeting where actual policy is discussed instead of whatever personality conflicts are going on. So I think he's putting a little rhythm there. Now, whether he can make Trump behave any better, who knows?
And I wonder if it's the last best chance for the administration to really operate like a normal functional policy shop or White House. I know it's only 6 months in, but the die is almost cast. He's a 70-year-old man who's not going to change his ways that
71
much.
71 now.
So, is he 71 now?
71.
Oh, were you at the birthday party or something?
The line that I have written in so many stories, he's 70. He's not going to change. I had to update it, 71.
Yeah. So, I mean, we know he's not going to change that much. So it'll be interesting to see, though, how much discipline Kelly is going to be able to inject into that operation. Because after a while, you know, once they get used to the chaos and operating by the seat of the pants, they're just going to continue that way because, you know, obviously Trump himself is the wellspring of that. So I'm very curious to see whether he's going to be able to especially stop the flow of bad information to the White House, because information flow is so central to that job. I mean, I don't think we've ever really had a case before, at least none that got into the press, about the president getting such bad information. When I say bad information, I'm talking about things like fake news reports that he believes to be real, or, you know, crazy Photoshop pictures, things like that. And even if he's able to just introduce a modicum of normalcy into that operation, you know, it could be curious to see what difference it makes.
Well, and when you give the president bad information, you know, he's supposing things and coming to decisions based on things that aren't true. And that's a little scary. You know, I don't think there's ever going to be a point where the president's not watching Fox and Friends, or he's not sometimes handed Breitbart articles, or is not sometimes given a fringe conspiracy news website story. But this was happening a lot. I mean, there were examples. I mean, our friend Shane, who's now at the New York Times, did a whole – it was an amazing story written about all the fake news that got on the president's desk, stories that had no basis in truth. I mean, zero truth to them.
Well, and the opening anecdote of that story was Reince Priebus ordering the staff to knock it off and them paying no attention to him whatsoever.
Right. It just it's bizarro material.
So what is Kelly just a stronger personality? Is that it? I mean, obviously he has the military background, right?
Charlie makes a really good point too. I mean, you saw back in the campaign where Trump said once about Reince Priebus, he knows better than to lecture me. We're not dealing with a five-star general here. I think John Kelly, you know, has that gravitas that Reince Priebus doesn't have. I also think it was seen as a bit of a last-ditch effort to bring him in. You know, if he can't fix his plagues and he leaves in 6 months or 3 months and says, he won't listen, I can't handle this, I don't know that he would do that, that's a pretty devastating blow to the presidency. I think he respects John Kelly a lot more. You know, one thing we heard consistently, even before he was named chief of staff, is he thinks DHS was one of his best run agencies.
What he's done in terms of homeland security is record shattering. You look at the border, you look at the tremendous results we've had, and you look at the spirit. We look forward to, if it's possible, an even better job as chief of staff.
He likes the border enforcement and, you know, all of the different programs that John Kelly put in place there. So I think if John Kelly can't fix it, then we have big problems for this administration going forward.
One last point before we wrap up this segment. I want to bring it back to immigration, where we started here and where John Kelly started his tenure in this administration. So, Josh, you said you think, you know, the prospects for this legislation in the Senate, in Congress, are slim. But what should we expect going forward? Like, what's the next step from the White House, from Cotton and Perdue, as this thing goes forward? Are they going to be holding hearings and trying to amplify the issue?
I was told to expect the White House and some of their conservative allies to begin building public consensus for this. I think we're going to see the White House talking about how popular it is. I think the president at some of his rallies is expected to talk about, you know, how popular curbing immigration is. Whether he sticks to the script at the rallies is, you know, a quintessential question of our time. But I do think you're going to see them build, you know, something of the case. And I mean, I already saw this flowing into my inbox this morning. You have a lot of these conservative groups saying, you know, the Democrats are going to have a problem on immigration. You know, limiting immigration is popular in all of these different districts and areas. And I think it's something you're going to see the White House try to exploit pretty aggressively over the next few months.
All right, we'll have to keep an eye on that going forward. Let's shift from there into a particular state where immigration has been a huge issue, and that state is Arizona. And the Republican senator from Arizona, Jeff Flake, is our particular topic for this segment. Our data point is 49%. That's the share of the vote that Flake won in 2012 when he was first elected to the Senate. He's up again in 2018. We mentioned this data point basically to say it's like, you know, he won with less than a majority last time. This guy is potentially in a tough race. He needs all the support he can get. But he has never been a fan of Donald Trump, and he has pretty much had enough at this moment, even in a moment when he needs the base. Here's an excerpt from his new book that was published in Politico earlier this week. To carry on in the spring of 2017 as if what was happening with the White House he's talking about was anything approaching normalcy required a determined suspension of critical faculties and tremendous powers of denial. And now Flake followed this up with a media tour. He's been on CNN. He's been on MSNBC over the past few days talking all about his many problems with Donald Trump, who he never endorsed in 2016, who he never supported.
We've kind of, as Republicans, taking up an unfamiliar banner that, you know, this populism and, you know, in some cases, xenophobia, anti-immigration, protectionism. That's not familiar to us. And I don't think that that is a governing philosophy.
Charlie, this is a remarkable move from a senator up for re-election in a potential swing state with a far-right challenger on his flank and Democrats hungrily eyeing the state as they have for a number of years.
Yeah, but what's really remarkable is that so few Republicans have been willing to do the same and break with the White House given the turmoil to date. But, you know, I think that's really probably more of a measure of our hyper-polarized environment. What's especially interesting, though, is that the White House's approach, I think that's even more remarkable. When has a White House ever so explicitly taken on an incumbent from their own party, especially probably the most endangered incumbent within their party? When has that ever happened? You know, I can't really think of an instance, and it's really not about ideology. I mean, in the past, if there were differences, you know, politicians were experienced enough to understand that, you know what, I may not like this person personally, but I need them as part of the coalition. And they recognize that, you know, we'll let bygones be bygones. But here, Trump hasn't. And a lot of it is rooted in the Access Hollywood scandal, where he remembers everyone who dropped him like a hot potato and wanted him out. And Flake was one of them.
Yeah. Apparently, Tim Alberto wrote a great story this weekend about a president kind of unmoored from a party and the traditional party discipline of, you know, no one really around him anymore who feels particular loyalty to the Republican Party. And I don't think Trump does. I mean, you saw his tweet this morning. Our relationship with Russia is at an all-time and very dangerous low. You can thank Congress, the same people who can't even give us health care. That's a pretty incendiary comment from a sitting president to make.
Yeah, when your party controls it.
Right. And you talk to a lot of these folks in the West Wing, and they make clear to you, we will distance ourselves from Congress happily if we need to. We would take on Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan if it got to that point. There is no particular love or affinity for Republican politics. I mean, Trump won as a Republican, but his whole career, if you watched him, he gave to Democrats. He, you know, supported Democrats. He's expressed a litany of issue, different positions on various issues. There's no affinity. We don't have a president who's a traditional party leader.
I think, and to that point, you know, among the other things that Jeff Flake wrote in that excerpt of his book that was printed in Politico that he's been saying, he criticized, not by name, but he criticized Mitch McConnell for saying during Obama's first term that the Republican Party's top goal was to make Obama a one-term president. He didn't mention McConnell by name, but he was criticizing that sentiment that everyone knows McConnell said. McConnell, however, pointedly declined to comment when Politico reporters asked his office about it after the fact, and that's the difference, right? The White House asked about it, said they were like, I think, what was it that Sarah Sanders said at the briefing on Wednesday?
He would do himself a favor to stop criticizing president. Yep. and do his job.
So that's the difference, right? Between kind of the party building and right. The attitude that sure. Someone like Mitch McConnell.
Right.
Adopts in the goal of counting to 50 over and over versus what someone like Trump, who has no patience right. Or interest in that, does.
But a lot of the Trump reaction, too, is visceral. You know, TVs are always running in the West Wing. They see Jeff Flake go on TV and bash him. They go after him. You know, they see a congressman or a senator say something in a newspaper. They go after them. You talk to folks close to McConnell and they think, it's fundamentally crazy. When they were going after, you know, Dean Heller and the healthcare fight and putting their outside group millions of dollars of ads, McConnell and his team, what? You're going to go after a vulnerable senator who needs to be reelected for us to keep a majority in the middle of a healthcare fight and hit him in his own state? That's like the antithesis of what they kind of see as politics. To Trump, he said something critical about Trump. Here we go.
One thing that hasn't been looked at very closely here is Flake's own political calculus. And I feel like this is a really
yes.
Overlooked part of this story. And let's just stipulate it's taken a good deal of political courage for him to break with his party. I mean, we don't see enough of that these days. You know, members on both sides are locked into party orthodoxy. And nobody will ever call out a member of their own party for any kind of sin whatsoever. Having said that, what he's doing is not nearly as suicidal as it seems, because at first you might think, well, you know, Trump's got a lot of support among the GOP base. Probably 8 out of 10 voters in most states support him still. Flake is definitely getting a primary challenge from the right, and it's going to be a really competitive one. But what people don't recognize is the system that Arizona has, and I think that Flake is working this. And here I'm talking about Arizona is not a closed primary. Arizona is like a hybrid system where if you're an independent or an unaffiliated voter, you can vote in that primary. So what Flake, I think, is doing is not nearly as suicidal in the sense that if he can build a coalition of Republicans who still like him or don't like Trump and get all these independents to vote for him in the primary, that is a winning coalition and that is enough to get him to victory. And I can envision a scenario where lots of Trump-hating independents would choose to vote in a Republican primary for the candidate who has bucked the president rather than vote in a boring Democratic primary. And so all of a sudden, you can see a way that Jeff Flake can get to victory in the primary despite pissing off lots of conservatives and despite alienating the president.
I guess the flip side of that, though, is a lot of, especially in midterm years, politics is about intensity, right? And so at this point, despite the credit he's getting from some Democrats for taking this public stand against the president, there's not much love lost between Jeff Flake and the Democratic Party, right? Jeff Flake is a very conservative Republican. He just voted for a ton of healthcare legislation that Democrats hate. I think he's voted to confirm almost all or all of President Trump's cabinet. And so there's that intensity on one side. And then the intensity in the Republican Party base right now is all around Trump. That he's the rallying point. And then so if you – there might be more people in the middle, but can you motivate them, I think, is the big question. Will he be able to get people excited about that?
Let's remember how much passion there is on the left and even in the center. When you look at the Trump's numbers with independents and moderates, they're not good.
Right.
You can easily see a scenario where there's lots of passion to vote even for somebody not of your party to get out there for Flake just to vote against Trump because he is the most visible opponent of Trump right now in the Republican Party.
That's a good point. Let's talk quickly along the lines of the Democrats that we just mentioned. There's an interesting roster of potential Democratic candidates shaping up here in Arizona. None of them have actually jumped in to the race. There is an activist who's in the race, but in terms of prominent elected officials, we haven't seen anyone jump in yet. But there's an interesting collection of them. There's a Blue Dog Democratic Congresswoman, Kyrsten Sinema. There's the mayor of Phoenix, Greg Stanton, who's kind of term limited. Out and is looking for his next thing. And then there's a state rep named Randy Fries, who is actually one of the doctors who treated Gabrielle Giffords when she was shot in 2011. And so kind of this interesting collection of potential candidates. I don't know how likely it is that any of them would end up running against each other versus the party kind of coalescing. Although, Charlie, as you know, Sinema also has some of her own problems with the Democratic base, with some of the votes that she's taken and affiliating as a Blue Dog and in Congress. But interesting collection of people there in a state that Democrats have eyed for a very long time without breaking through.
And it's revealing, I think, just about the transitional state of Arizona. It was so conservative for many years. And now there's so much talk about it being a purple state or a state that's evolving into a much more competitive swing state. Clearly the breadth of that field, the ideological breadth of that field gives you a flavor for that. You have the mayor of the biggest city. You've got Sinema who, as you mentioned, there are lots of Democrats in that state that see her as a little bit too calculating, always angling for the next office. I had an Arizona Democrat once in describing her just point to his mouth like a gagging reflex, like, oh my God, I can't believe, his point being he found her voting record so appalling given the nature of her district that he felt that was almost unforgivable that she would depart from the party line so often.
Which is remarkable because when she ran for Congress in 2012, she was in a crowded Democratic primary and then in a tough general election, and Republicans essentially attacked her as a communist on her state
Does
legislative
that still work?
Voting record. And now here we are. Josh, wrapping up here, what should we expect from the White House? I mean, we talked a little bit about what their reaction has been so far. But if Flake keeps up, that certainly the publicity tour shows no signs of stopping. His book isn't actually even out yet. Once it's out, there is going to be a lot more for people to chew on. And this is clearly something he wants to be talking about a lot. And whether he actually does think there's political upside in terms of finding this middle path, or if he's just decided that it's not worth being a senator anymore, if he doesn't get to say this stuff, he's going to be saying it. So how is this going to evolve? I mean, how do you see this progressing?
I think you certainly could see the White House fighting back pretty hard. I think we've already seen that a little bit, through emissaries, through Steve Bannon's brother out in Arizona, through various donors. They're already talking about challengers putting money in the race, the affiliated outside groups. If they can ever get their act together and figure out how to do politics, I think they would go after him. You could see the president getting in a barbed exchange. Someone in the West Wing joked to me, I don't know how serious they were because it's really hard to know with anything these days, that they would campaign against him in Arizona if they needed to. They would find a challenger and campaign against him. Now, I'm not saying that they will do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think
people are thinking about it.
People are thinking about it, sure. I mean, they really dislike this guy. And the more he does TV, the more I think you'll see Trump really go after him. And it's not just Trump. You know, every time you walk through the West Wing, there's several big TVs in every office. They're on every network. I mean, they know what people are saying. Volume on. If Jeff Flake is on TV constantly with his book talking about Trump, hitting Trump, saying Trump's incompetent, unqualified, doesn't know what he's doing, it could be an inter-party squabble like for the ages. I mean, it really would be fun to watch.
It's a great point. It's going to be one of the best spectacles to watch next year, because think about it this way. If he loses the primary, he has nothing less to lose, and he's just going to light up Trump for the rest of his time in Congress.
Right.
If he wins the primary, he's also going to be politically incentivized to take on Trump.
Yes.
Because all of a sudden he's going to have a competitive general election against a Democrat, and he's going to need to win over lots of independents. And the thing about Arizona is that Arizona has an enormous population of unaffiliated or independent voters, at least equal to the percentage of Republicans. Roughly a third of the state is unaffiliated or independent.
And you could see the president, you know, talking about immigration a lot in Arizona. I think in his mind, he affiliates Arizona with immigration. And you know, the wall, and with the sheriff, I can't remember his name off the top
Arpaio.
Of my head, but Joe Arpaio, the tough-talking sheriff. You know, you could see Trump really using Arizona as a cudgel to have a broader message on immigration and bash Flake pretty hard.
Right, and he and Flake are definitely not coming from the same place on immigration. Well, that's going to be a fun one to watch. We're going to get to watch it for over a year, because Arizona has late primaries, and then, of course, there's a general election after that. So it should be a fun one to keep an eye on, especially if Flake does stay out there. Josh, thank you so much for joining
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take a quick break to hear about one of Politico's other podcasts. All right. For our third and final segment this week, we are going to talk about Alabama, which has a Senate special election, special primary coming up in a few weeks. And here to talk about it, we have Daniel Strauss, one of our political reporters who has been covering that very closely. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So our data point is $8 million. That is how much money Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's political network, and chiefly here we're talking about the super PAC that's aligned with him and run by his former chief of staff. $8 million is how much they are prepared to spend in the upcoming Alabama Senate special election, an election that Republicans are virtually assured to win because it's Alabama. The primary is coming up on August 15th to complete the rest of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' term, since he left the Senate earlier this year. So, Daniel, why is so much money coming into a safe Republican state?
I mean, on the surface, it really doesn't seem to make very much sense, right? Because there's going to be a Republican in this seat no matter what. But the personalities involved in this race is what makes the difference. And you have Mitch McConnell is supporting Senator Luther Strange, the incumbent there, who's found himself as a favorite among Senate leadership. And
he was appointed, right?
Right. He was appointed by former Governor Robert Bentley. And he's really endeared himself to Mitch McConnell. So for McConnell, he sees the value of winning this seat and winning a reliable Republican vote. But beyond that, also, $8 million sounds like a lot, but compared to other states, it's actually a relatively modest sum. So this is a way for Mitch McConnell to demonstrate that he's serious about incumbent protection and he's serious about protecting his own within the Senate.
Oh, that's a good point. So even as we were just talking about with Jeff Flake and the possible primary stuff, that this is sending a message.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Charlie, the other two, it's a very crowded Republican field here, but the two Republicans who have established themselves as Strange's main rivals here are not what you would call Mitch McConnell Republicans.
Yeah, and I think that explains why McConnell is so engaged in this race. I mean, in his mind, in the mind of an establishment Republican like Mitch McConnell, the alternatives to Strange are so much worse. It's not just that he wants a reliable vote. He'll get a reliable a senator who can cast a vote that he will like out of Alabama. But there's a big difference between Luther Strange and Roy Moore and Mo Brooks, because Moore and Brooks are from the sort of bomb-throwing school of Republican politicians. They're both, you know, to a large degree, loose cannons and independent operators. They are exactly the kind of politicians that have made Mitch McConnell's life a nightmare in recent years, you know, and they are the kind of politicians that have helped fracture Republican unity. And the other factor here that's really interesting is the Trump factor. It's almost like this X factor that's hovering over this race, because Trump is, in a lot of ways, he's like the king of Alabama. I mean, who would have ever believed that a non-church-going Manhattan billionaire who once characterized himself as very pro-choice would become so wildly popular in such a conservative state? But, you know, that is the case. And it's been the case since he did that big, that huge rally in Mobile early in the campaign. And so suddenly he casts a very big shadow over Alabama politics.
Yeah. I mean, look, the truth is Trump has a lot to thank Alabama for. It's where he got his first Senate endorsement in Jeff Sessions, who's all like equally as popular as Trump there. And it really it's the first state where there was this Trump likes to call attention to getting huge crowds. And we're talking sort of football field level huge crowds, which started in Alabama. But, you know, Charlie also brings up a really good point here about Brooks and Moore. Like on the surface, again, these are Republican votes. But if you the possibility of someone like Mo Brooks going to the Senate and then giving Mitch McConnell a headache on a really contentious close vote like an Obamacare repeal vote is not really that far-fetched.
Mo Brooks being a member of the House Freedom Caucus, which has kind of made its name saying voting no on legislation because it wasn't conservative enough as opposed to kind of the traditional horse trading in the middle. And then Roy Moore, I mean, a little background here. Roy Moore, former Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court, has been elected twice and removed twice from that office for violating orders of the federal government, essentially. I mean, one to remove a statue of the Ten Commandments that had been installed on government property. And then he made a comeback run and then was taken off again because he refused to enforce the Supreme Court decision mandating that states permit same-sex marriage within their borders. And so he has a very, very strong following. But it's Brooks who has been the main target for Senate Leadership Fund, the Senate Republican super PAC. And as Charlie said, they've been using Trump as the cudgel, right? Because Brooks
was a longtime supporter during the 2016 presidential election of Ted Cruz. It's all sort of connected to each other.
Oh, I hadn't thought about it that way.
But the other interesting thing about the Trump factor is that I'm dying to see what happens to his appeal there. And I wonder if it's dissipating a little bit as he continues to abuse Jeff Sessions. I mean, he's dialed it back a little bit. But let's not forget, Jeff Sessions was beloved by the Republican base in Alabama. And in fact, we had a pretty interesting story a couple weeks ago where one of our reporters called into Alabama to see what people thought of Trump's very public criticism of Jeff Sessions. And people were really torn and emotional about this. Many of them said at the same time, they're very supportive of Donald Trump. They felt that the media was giving him an unfair shake and was and they believed, you know, a lot of the Trump rhetoric about a witch hunt against him. But at the same time, they felt that he was being deeply unfair to a very decent person. And what was really striking about that story was, of the people we talked to, and we talked to lots of county officials and local legislators and folks like that, more than a handful described Sessions as having the potential to be the greatest attorney general in U.S. history. Literally. And so it gives you a sense
he's
of
revered.
Who compiles those rankings?
the greatest? I think that's Sports Illustrated.
Yeah. Right?
Or maybe the AP has a result.
Something like that.
Yeah.
No, but Mo Brooks tried to leverage this, right? So he sent out this proposal saying if Jeff Sessions is ousted by the Trump administration from his position, we should all drop out and allow Jeff Sessions to return to his former Senate seat.
This is a move by a candidate who's behind in the polls, right? We should
this
say
is,
like this is a desperate.
This is not a move by someone who's going to comfortably win this race.
Brooks is getting outspent. He's getting out-advertised. Moore starts with a lot more name recognition among the challengers, right? And Strange has this big money machine behind him. So it's one of several desperate moves that we've seen from Brooks recently that feed into this, right? Tell us a little more about that.
So, look, for a time, Luther Strange's poll numbers weren't moving, publicly or privately. But Luther Strange and his allies started this aggressive campaign attacking Brooks as not a Trump supporter, not really hitting on the Jeff Sessions point, but really contrasting him as like not supportive of where a lot of Alabamians are. And so Brooks had to respond in some way. And after a little while of this sort of like onslaught, he did a few things. Number one, he released an ad highlighting his actions during this shooting at a Republican congressional baseball team practice.
The one that wounded Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip.
Right.
Does this change your views on the gun situation in America?
The Second Amendment, right to bear arms, is to help ensure that we always have a republic. So no, I'm not changing my position on any of the rights that we enjoy as Americans.
That shooting ad backfired in a way because I really shouldn't have chosen that verb. I'm sorry.
Who could have thought that
you guys are my two politicizing. You guys have edited me a lot. You know, Scott currently, Charlie in the past, and I'm pretty sure if this is in copy, you would have cut that out.
Who could have thought that politicizing a mass shooting would somehow backfire in a Republican?
And it did it pretty spectacularly. Scalise's chief of staff responded pretty directly on Twitter to that.
And it when you look back now at the coverage, it looks especially distasteful because I think for most of our listeners, the coverage you would have seen from the early hours of the shooting when there was a lot of chaos and uncertainty about the details, the voice you would have heard on CNN was Mo Brooks. He was the congressman who right out of the gate was in front of all the cameras. And at the time, it seemed normal and understandable given the trauma of the incident. People were desperate for details, and he was very matter of fact about it. But now looking back, now that he's used it in campaign ads, it begins to look a little bit more calculating and carries a much more unpleasant whiff now that it turns out he's used it pretty aggressively.
Yeah, Alabamians I talked to started to point out sort of like 48 or 72 hours after the coverage, they started to say to me, look, Brooks is on TV and talking about this stuff a lot. He's not turning down any interviews. I wonder if he's going to leverage this down the line or if he's going to try and tie this into the Alabama Senate race. And in the end, it seems like that's what happened. But interestingly, you know, Senator Strange's campaign hasn't really directly criticized him for that. He's let them sort of bowl over here. And what's been impressive about Strange's campaign is that he didn't come into this race as a super popular figure. There's a long history and a lot of criticism about Strange and how, as Attorney General, he was starting to look at Governor Bentley and sort of corruption and sort of abuse of his office. And then when the option came up, his critics say, to take the Senate seat, he
stepped off the gas
a little bit. He slowed down the investigation a little bit.
Interesting.
But now the needle is sort of ticking into Strange's favor. His poll numbers are up. He's winning the money game. He's got a lot of support from Senator Richard Shelby, who has a lot of pull in the state among Alabama donors. And these other campaigns are starting to really struggle very visibly here.
So this primary is coming up on August 15th. The way Alabama runs their elections is that if no one gets to 50% in the primary, which seems likely, although it's not set in stone, but it seems likely because the field is so crowded, there will be a runoff between the top two, primary runoff for the Republican nomination in September. And then with the general election, which a lot of people assume is more or less a formality, Alabama being what it is, later this year.
Right. I mean, look, I am a little surprised with how much of a formality it's shaping up to be. Democrats in D.C. were really excited about Doug Jones, a former U.S. attorney who has this sort of proud civil rights history, and they were hoping that they could sort of capitalize on the infighting here. But he's actually polling below an also-ran candidate.
Who happens to be named Robert Kennedy.
Robert Kennedy.
That's a tough blow.
Yeah, he's unrelated.
You violated a cardinal sin. You've got to learn that you never listen to anything D.C. Democrats say about the South. Anything. You take a look at the map below the Mason-Dixon line. When they talk about a race in the South, you ignore it. I mean, when they're telling you that they're going to be players in Alabama and, you know, Mississippi and places like that. I mean, come on, you know.
They did this in Mississippi, too. I covered that race in 14 very closely. They had Travis Childers, this former U.S. representative from Mississippi, who they were hoping would capitalize on the chaos here. And he imploded in the same way. He just disappeared.
Yeah. So, all right. So we got that primary coming up. Remember, August 15th. That's our next big special election that we're keeping track of. Daniel, thank you very much for coming in to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie, thank you as always.
Nice to see you again, Scott.
And as always, a big thank you to our listeners. Remember, email us with any questions you have at nerdcast@politico.com. And please also subscribe, rate us, and write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. So once again, thank you to our listeners. Thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our producer, Rachel Cusick, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and Nerdcast researcher, Zach Montalaro. We will talk to you again next week.